Munger, and this is the, as I said, the 51st session. It's the title of this session is From Battle Hymns to Songs of Peace. I need to remind you that admission is by name tag or ticket only to the sessions, and if you haven't registered yet, you can do so in the lobby. Let me tell you about this session a little first. Unlike some of the other sessions, this isn't going to be a panel discussion. It's going to be a series of readings. And each of the readers will introduce their piece when their time comes. I hope that as you're listening, as well as enjoying listening to the stories and the poems and the essays that they'll be reading, I hope you'll also think about what peace is or what it would be like. I was realizing as I was putting this together that I have a very hard time visualizing what a world at peace would be like, or even how we would actually go about achieving peace. It seems that it's just an absence of war, and yet I know that it's more than that. And so if you think about that, there may be some time for questions at the end of the reading. Let me introduce the readers to you. Our first reader will be Casey Munger. He's a network engineer in technical support at Novell, and is originally from Twin Falls, Idaho. He studied electrical engineering at Brigham Young University and has a fascination with church history, and he also happens to be my husband. The next is Mike Austin. He's a graduate student in English at BYU and from Enid, Oklahoma. At BYU, he teaches freshman English and freshman reading, as well as assistant teaching the Romantic, Victorian, and Modern English course. He was president of the College Democrats in 88 and 89. His emphasis of study is political rhetoric, and he's writing his thesis on Richard Wright and the rhetoric of consensus. Tori Anderson will speak next. He's a master's graduate from the English program at BYU and an Air National Guardsman. He writes short stories, several of which have appeared in The New Era, Inscape, and the Dickinson's Review. And he just told me that he's gotten a letter back from The New Yorker as well, saying write again, which is always exciting for a writer. He's married to Barbara Call, and they have three sons. After Tori will be Eugene England. He's a professor of English literature at BYU and the teacher of the family history writing class in his Provo, Utah ward. He's married to Charlotte Hawkins England, and they have six children and nine grandchildren. His most recent books are Converted by Christ by the Book of Mormon, Harvest, Contemporary Mormon Poems, which was also edited with Dennis Clark, and Beyond Romanticism, Tuckerman's Life and Poetry. He writes personal essays, poetry, and criticism of American and Mormon literature and of Shakespeare. He is presently at work on books on the poet Leslie Norris and on Shakespeare, and is editing a collection of Mormon stories. Next will be Joanne Giordano, who will be graduating this month both in English and in teaching English as a second language from BYU. Her undergraduate majors were in English and in international relations. As well as teaching the standard freshman English classes, she also teaches multicultural classes for both foreign students and U.S. students that are from minorities. She's has also done that for workshops and conferences. And she and her husband, Eric, will be moving to Boston in 2 weeks, where they plan to eventually take up Ph.D. programs. Bruce Jorgensen will read after Joanne. He is an associate professor of English literature at BYU and has also taught at BYU Hawaii, Ithaca College, Southern Utah State, Syracuse University, and Cornell. He married Donna June Dutro, and they are the parents of three girls and five boys. He's had several of his poems reprinted in the recent anthology of Mormon poetry, Harvest. And in addition to poetry, he writes short stories and critical essays on Mormon and American literature. Our final reader will be Denise Williams, who graduated from Brigham Young University as a BA with a German minor. She and her husband, David, live in Provo, Utah. They have almost six children. She also teaches piano and intends to enter the master's program in humanities at BYU. Each reader, as I said, will introduce the piece that they're reading as they come up. As we only have 90 minutes, I want to remind the readers that most of them have been asked to limit themselves to about 15 minutes so that there will be some time for the questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Jan. It seems to go without saying that the gospel of peace is at odds with war. One of our earlier prophets, David O. McKay, has even gone so far to say but wars the antithesis of the gospel and produces hate, and that it is vain to attempt to reconcile war with true Christianity. There came a time for the early saints, however, when it seemed the only way for them to have peace in their valley was to follow the example of Captain Moroni with his title of liberty and fight for it. I'm referring to what is known as the Utah War. 10 years after the saints first settled in the Salt Lake Valley, the President of the United States, President Buchanan, sent troops to quell the Mormon insurrection in Utah. Brigham Young, who was the governor of Utah Territory at the time, declared that the approaching troops, popularly known as Johnston's Army, were an illegal mob, since the U.S. government had not informed him otherwise. Charles W. Penrose wrote a rousing battle hymn for the occasion, although this would be no battle like any other that the U.S. troops had faced before. The orders passed from Brigham Young to his general, Daniel H. Wells, and on to the other military leaders were to take no life, but destroy their trains and stampede or drive away their animals at every opportunity in a type of guerrilla warfare. Despite the injunction to shed no blood, you will notice that the words of Penrose's hymn do not express attitudes of Christian forbearance and brotherly love, but instead what must have seemed to the hastily gathered Mormon militia justifiable hostility and righteous anger. The hymn: Up, awake, ye defenders of Zion, the foes at the door of your homes. Let each heart be the heart of a lion, unyielding and proud as he roams. Remember the wrongs of Missouri. Forget not the fate of Nauvoo. When the God-hating foe is before you, stand firm and be faithful and true. By the mountains are Zion's surrounded. Her warriors are noble and brave, and their faith on Jehovah is founded, whose power is mighty to save. Opposed by a proud, boasting nation, their numbers compared may be few, but their union is known through creation, and they've always been faithful and true. Shall we bear with oppression forever? Shall we tamely submit to the foe? While the ties of our kindred they sever, and the blood of our prophets shall flow? No, the thought sets the heart wildly beating. Our vows at each pulse we renew, ne'er to rest till our foes are retreating, and to ever be faithful and true. Though assisted by legions infernal, the plundering wretches advance. With a host from the regions eternal, we'll scatter their troops at a glance. Soon the kingdom will be independent. In wonder the nations will view the despised ones in glory resplendent. Then let us be faithful and true. Thank you.
Okay. What I'd like to read and share with you is a brief essay in progress that concerns my attempts to come to grips with the concept of pacifism and the nature of imagining a society without war, or at least a personal philosophy that doesn't include, necessitate, or even justify war. It's something that I've struggled with quite a bit this year during the events that we've seen over in the Persian Gulf and elsewhere. And when I was first asked to write a paper about it, the paper that I imagined myself writing was very different than what I have now. And I imagined that were I asked to write a paper about it in a few months, it would again be very different, because this is a concept. This is me trying to put down on paper the sort of thoughts and ideas and feelings that most people have but rarely put down on paper until they're asked to. I don't have a title for it, though it's tentatively titled Why I Consider Myself a Mormon Pacifist, because what it's about is why I consider myself a Mormon pacifist. And we'll go with that title, though that too, along with everything else, I preface, is subject to change. A week after Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait last August, I proclaimed myself a pacifist and determined to prove to anyone who would listen that God would accept no position other than my own. I quickly set out to memorize scripture citations, conference talks by Hubie Brown, and poems by Spencer W. Kimball in an effort to prove beyond dispute that both the Lord and his church must categorically oppose war. Soon, however, I found that others were memorizing lists and building cases of their own. After a while, the religious arguments for and against our involvement in the Gulf became as familiar to me as the opening sequences of a textbook perfect chess game. hobby of mine. Move 1, Doctrine and Covenants 98:16, renounce war and proclaim peace. Counter move, Alma 62:29, whosoever would not take up arms in defense of their country were put to death. The Queen's Gambit. Have you read about the anti-Nephi Lehis, the greatest conscientious objectors of all time? The acceptance. Of course. But what about their children, the 2,000 brave sons of Ammon who killed many in battle and suffered no losses themselves? But these were different. These were wars authorized by the prophets of the Lord. Ah, didn't you read about Thomas S. Monson's talk? He said that this was a just war and that we shouldn't protest. Then into the mid-game. Fascist, Pinko, Pig, and so on. Both of us invoking scriptural authority and placing them in the context of a heated discussion. This exercise, though, merely confirms something I have known for some time, that the scriptures often appear ambiguous and are open to private interpretations. My actual feelings during the war were never constant. At times I was livid with our government and our country for plunging into an economically motivated war. At other times I felt a guilty sense of pleasure at the thought that a thug like Hussein was finally getting his comeuppance. Most of the time, though, I was devastated by the destruction that I saw on TV and thought of the devastation that must have occurred but was never shown. Officially, I still proclaimed myself a pacifist. Though I was not really sure what a pacifist was, I was glad that I was one. I thought, incorrectly, that by applying this label to myself, somehow cleared me of responsibility for the destruction I saw on TV. In the months since the war ended, I had become aware that being a pacifist must involve more than simply applying a label to oneself and speaking in glittering generalities, such as violence is wrong, and we must always reject war as an instrument of foreign policy. As a sidelight, my good friend Matt Stannard here, who gave a very fine speech this morning, just a few weeks ago, showed me the error of speaking in glittering generalities such as those, and I'm very grateful to him. Because such sweeping abstractions, though often rhetorically effective, become excuses to avoid the ethical responsibility that comes with making hard choices in concrete situations. Pacifism, however, is no guarantee of ethical purity. We can never be sure that a decision to avoid violence will not directly result in more violence. We can't guarantee that peaceful methods of persuasion, such as boycotts and economic sanctions, won't kill more people slowly than a war would quickly. And we cannot, in good conscience, ignore the moral questions that follow from these uncertainties. These are extremely complicated moral issues, and they must be considered individually. Abstract universal statements, such as war is always the wrong choice, attempt to be easy answers to difficult questions. For these reasons, I now stop short of saying that war is always the wrong choice, yet I continue to call myself a pacifist. I do not believe that the use of force has been justified at any time in my life, and my reading of history convinces me that, with very few and very questionable exceptions, war has never been right. Though I cannot invoke a categorical imperative to justify these views, neither can I approach any situation as an ethical blank slate. Making difficult moral choices requires something upon which to base a decision. There are no sure bets. Everybody must construct his or her own ethic and then do everything possible to live by it. For the remainder of my presentation, I will outline some of the points at which I base my definition of myself as a pacifist. Because the gospel is important to me, my arguments are rooted in the scriptures and the statements of the living prophets. However, I must recognize that others, working with the same text, can reach other, no less valid conclusions. Ultimately, I can cite only my personal conscience as proof that what I say is true. First area I'd like to analyze is pacifism and the just war doctrine. As a pacifist, I believe that there is no such thing as a just war. Despite the arguments of numerous philosophers and theologians over centuries to set forth the conditions under which war can be considered just, I maintain that justice and war are incompatible phenomena. Words like justice, fairness, morality, right, and wrong do not exist in Platonic realms where they wait only to be discovered by especially enlightened souls. They have meaning only in relationship to the discourse community in which they are defined and maintained. Justice, then, is a function of dialogue. War, on the other hand, represents the complete breakdown of dialogue. As soon as people from different nations and cultures begin killing each other, we can be quite sure that negotiation, in any real sense, has disintegrated. A war can never be just, because the very fact of war negates the only conditions in which justice can have meaning. On a more concrete level, I believe that war is never just because wars violate a universally accepted principle of justice, that the punishment must somehow be connected to the transgression. In a war, the people who do the sinning are never the same as the people who do the dying. For example, during the war in the Gulf, Pentagon estimates Iraqi casualties at about 48,000 tanks. Once this rather cynical estimate is converted into people, we can put the number of dead Iraqis at about 200,000, a figure that will almost certainly exceed 500,000, many of them innocent children, when the damage to Iraq's infrastructure takes its final toll. And none of these people is Saddam Hussein, who may well outlast George Bush as a player on the world stage. Second area that I'd like to look at is the issue of pacifism versus pacifism. One of the most difficult questions for a pacifist to answer is the one that goes, are you for just sitting there and letting aggressive tyrants do whatever they want? This question is usually accompanied by an allegory, something along the lines of, suppose you come out of your bedroom with a gun and see your wife, your children, and everybody else in your extended family tied up on the floor with Norman Bates standing over them holding a knife. Wouldn't you shoot to protect your family? Well, it's the same thing in Kuwait. We're just helping our brothers and sisters. Just for the record, I'll confess, I'd shoot Norman right between the eyes and rescue my family. But I'm still a pacifist, and this analogy has nothing to do with whether or not we should ever go to war. If a small, defenseless nation is mercilessly plundered, does not the international community have the right to come to mutually exclusive? Violence is only one of many possible actions, and it is rarely even the most effective one. 20th century leaders such as Gandhi and Martin Luther King have shown us what Christ taught long ago, that it is possible to act directly, substantially, and effectively without killing people. When the entire international community is united, it requires only patience, creativity, and courage to actively oppose aggression without ever resorting to violence. Mahatma Gandhi was fond of saying that if cowardice were the only alternative to violence, it would be better to fight. And, as Gandhi demonstrated throughout his life, the possibilities of creative resistance are endless for those who are subject to the direct oppression of a tyrant. Refusing to fight is not the same as laying down to die. There are always other options. These options, however, are more difficult than fighting. Intelligent, nonviolent resistance requires courage and creativity. Like a soldier, the passive resistance is willing to die. However, unlike the soldier, she is unwilling to kill. Nonviolent methods of resisting aggression are superior to war for two reasons. First, they are more effective in addressing the long-range implications of violence. The problems that we have faced in every war run deeper than their historical roots in any particular time. The world has been caught in a cycle of violence for millennia, and this violence feeds on itself. Even oppressed groups who manage to defeat their violent oppressors invariably learn the lesson of violence well and perpetuate the cycle to become the new violent oppressors. It is impossible, I maintain, to effectively halt this cycle through a war to end all wars. And though acts of violence may temporarily realign the superstructure, they reinforce the basic paradigm of violence in our society. But there are even more important spiritual reasons that I believe nonviolent direct action is superior to violence. Simply put, I think that it is more ethical. This is one of the points at which I consider myself a Mormon pacifist. I believe that the commandment not to kill comes from an all-wise, all-powerful God. I am perfectly willing to concede that God has both the power and the right to make life and death decisions in this world. Thus, I have no problem with scriptural accounts of God commanding Nephi to kill Laban or the Israelites to go to war. The problem, however, comes when humans find in these accounts permission to play God without permission. The fact that it took something as dramatic as direct communication from God to authorize these actions suggests to me that, barring such revelations, we should stick firmly to the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." It is often possible to defeat physical violence with more physical violence, but this, I believe, exacts a cost from the soul. Becoming a murderer is too high a price to pay for stopping a murderer. Furthermore, the Mormon conception of the human being as an eternal being suggests that what we do in this life is more important than what is done to us. A pacifist, then, might take an attitude towards oppression something like this. What you have done is wrong. By acting this way, you can take away my liberty, you can kill me, but you cannot force me to abandon my moral principles and become like you. I will resist you with every nonviolent means at my disposal, but I will not, on your account, place my soul in jeopardy by killing you. That is the one thing you cannot force me to do. One more area that I'd like to discuss is something that Kenneth Burke, in his Grammar of Motives, calls the purification of war. Burke proposes that because of the nature of mankind, of humankind, it is impossible to do away with conflict. Instead, he proposes that we work towards the purification of war. A pure war, according to Burke, is one that is carried out with words. In acknowledgement of Berg's program, I would like to note a difference between a pacifist and a non-confrontationalist. Though I reject violence as a means to political ends, I believe that rhetorical confrontation is both an acceptable and a necessary part of establishing a dialogue in which we can address our differences before they become violent. I do not see debate and discussion, even heated discussion, as precursors to violence. On the contrary, legitimate differences will always exist, and addressing these differences in open dialogue is a necessary step in avoiding violent conflict. Unfortunately, most of us have been socially constructed to believe that consensus is good and confrontation is bad. Consequently, we often suppress disagreement in dialogue, only to see the same disagreement emerge later on as violent conflict. In my opinion, one of the most destructive sentiments to emerge from the Gulf War was the idea that once President and Congress decided to go to war, dissenters should get in line and support the troops. This argument, far from manifesting patriotism, attempts to negotiate the traditions of open debate and discussion that have always characterized America. If it is true, as I believe, that war represents the failure of dialogue, then there is no argument that a committed Christian should not prefer to a violent conflict. In the spirit of Kenneth Burke, I would like to state that I do not object to war. I object to violence. My deepest feelings tell me that violence is wrong and that humanity is capable of breaking the cycle of terror that has raged for thousands of years. While conflict may well be inherent to our natures, and therefore war, I believe that it's possible to form communities in which the conflict that now requires bloodshed can be carried out in newspapers and lecture halls. Such communities, though, require that our political dialogues be open to ideas from any sector. In other words, peace requires work. War is a relatively easy proposition. It requires very little creativity, and there are plenty of models to follow. Like many of the Lord's injunctions, though, the injunction to renounce war and proclaim peace will require us to revise our habits, our perceptions, and perhaps even our definitions of right and wrong. The reason that I consider myself a pacifist is that I consider it important to begin this process of reexamination with myself and within any discussion that I'm allowed to enter. I realize that my views and theories are incomplete and tentative. They changed significantly as I was writing this paper and will undoubtedly change again throughout my life. But in all honesty, the discussion in this paper does not characterize my true opposition to war. Like any theoretical discourse, my points A, B, and C represent a post hoc justification for something that I have believed for a long time, that war is wrong. This feeling is entirely behind why I call myself a Mormon pacifist. Though I can find plenty of justification for a pacifist theology in the scriptures, in the words of the prophets, and in the gospel as it has been taught to me, the reason that I connect pacifism and Mormonism so closely is that, for me, they come from the same source. Both are represented in me by the same intangible, personal, and ultimately unexplainable feeling. I know that the church is true, and I know that I should oppose war, or at least violence. While I can construct plenty of rhetorical arguments in favor of both propositions, pacifism and the gospel, I am well aware that my constructions are fallible and refutable. A testimony, though, is something that I start with rather than something that I arrive at, and when pressed, I must admit that I remain a pacifist for the very same reason that I remain a member of the church, because it feels true to me. This does not mean that I withdraw into a shell of testimony. I believe that it is important for us all to meet together in forums such as this and discuss issues such as these. Ultimately, though, it is a matter of conscience for me, and as with all matters of conscience, there comes a point at which I must draw a line in the sand and say, here I stand, I can do no more. Thank you.
My name is Tori Anderson. I hold an MA in the field of English, as has already been said, and by profession, I'm an editor and typesetter for a local publisher. However, on weekends, I become Sergeant Anderson, an early warning radar maintenance specialist with the 109th Tactical Control Squadron in the Utah Air National Guard. Because of this affiliation, I've been asked to read a personal essay written from the unique point of view of Hugh Drews, a German man who has chosen as his career to be an officer in the German Army. This paper was first published in the winter 1984 issue of Dialogue. Written at a time when the nuclear arms race was still going strong, some of the dated material has been edited. Remaining are some interesting thoughts on the relationship of the professional soldier and peace. Thoughts of a Modern Centurion by Hugh Drews. I was born and raised in Bremen, a city in northwest Germany, in a middle-class family. At age 15, I became interested in politics, joined a neo-orthodox communistic cell group at high school, and absorbed Marxist philosophy with a passion. Thousands of young Germans were experiencing the same passion in the late 1960s to create a new society dominated by peace and justice. In 1968, riots at the university signaled a strong resistance to the establishment, and an opposition party outside parliament was founded by some radicals. In 1970, I was in crisis. I discovered that the people I most wanted to help were not experiencing peace and justice, but hate and despair. With despair of my own, I abandoned the idea of changing society by pressure and revolution. Instead, I began exploring ways of changing individual members of that society. Part of my search was a religious quest. One day, I encountered two missionaries of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when they were tracking in my neighborhood. After 3 weeks of investigation and a tough internal struggle, I gained a testimony that God really existed and that the historical Jesus of Nazareth was not only a social reformer ahead of his time, but the Son of God. I became a member of the church in 1972, the only member of my Protestant family to do so. I attended the University of Bonn, and in 1974, I joined the Armed Forces of Germany as a volunteer, where I am now an officer. My choice of a profession is unusual, but not unique for a Latter-day Saint. About 100 German members, including perhaps 40 draftees, are currently serving in the armed forces. Among them are the branch presidents of Würzburg and Hyde, and high counselors from Hanover and Munich Stakes. Still, it is not a popular choice, and I have been forced to think deeply about my religious and civic commitments as peace movements in Europe have gained intensity and momentum. As the intensity and momentum of the peace movement grew even stronger, the explosive public discussion about nuclear weapons, disarmament, and direction which the peace movement should take did not stop at the church doors, and German Latter-day Saints struggled to find their own positions on the issue. These efforts were both helped and handicapped by a lack of an official church statement comparable to the Pastoral Letter for Catholics, which spells out the moral and ethical implications of modern peace endeavors produced by West Germany's Catholic bishops in April 1983. The appearance of this letter suddenly sharpened the focus on religious aspects of the peace question. Members reported their confusion and even embarrassment when colleagues and neighbors asked them for their opinions as a Mormon. Although many of them had personal opinions, they did not know what the Mormon opinion was. Several approached me, knowing I was serving in the army. Occasionally, the topic came up in Sunday school classes, but in most cases, nobody answered. In one ward, the bishop and many members decided to join with several anti-nuclear groups for a peace demonstration. All the churches of the city had been invited to participate, and the bishop felt that it would be appropriate to have the ward represented. He asked the stake president for clearance a month in advance. After 3 weeks of hesitation, the stake president forbade participation, then only days before the meeting was to occur. Reports also reached me that several ward and branch sacrament meetings had heard talks on the subject, but that the priesthood leader firmly squelched any follow-up and rebuked those who had spoken, fearing that any topic with political potentiality could create dissension. Nearly every week, a letter comes asking for my opinion on the subject. Most of them say they have talked to a bishop or stake president, but that these leaders have not been able to give them any information. The church has no official position. No guidance in the handbook or article in an official magazine seems to point a direction. Only two articles on military service have been translated in German, both as part of the seminary program. This is your choice, they say, or the church has no position. The implication clearly left in the members' mind is not that they are free to come to their own conclusions, but that any conclusion is somehow suspect because it is not approved by the church. Lack of an official position does not open the door for a variety of personal positions, but instead makes any position at all questionable. Many members of the church in West Germany have lived with the daily reality of the Iron Curtain. Many had relatives in German Democratic Republic. The experiences of World War II left still deep scars. Many older members who survived these years are convinced that any kind of militarism is unrighteous. Some totally reject militarism in any form and try to influence the young men to become conscientious objectors. In their view, the only real choice for a Mormon Christian. When I joined the army, 5 other young men in the ward were contemplating the same action. Local priesthood leaders were sufficiently influential that the other 4 changed their minds. One elders' quorum president refused to shake hands with me after he heard of my decision. Since that time, I felt the reservation of some members, even when I have served in a stake presidency or on a high council. I've heard criticism of the rough military atmosphere I create, possibly a fair criticism. I am sympathetic with these members who have had the experiences which led to such aggressive pacifism. I'm not convinced, however, when they argue that since Germany began 2 world wars, we can never take up arms again, although the United States is apparently free to. The situations are not, in my mind, so completely different. Their aggressive pacifism is underscored by the destruction of explicit patriotism as a result of the way the Third Reich corrupted the German love of homeland. As a result of their church membership, many German members feel a certain bond with the United States, but it does not necessarily include harmony on political issues and is far from the universal sentiment in any case. Because of my profession, I have wrestled with many of these questions, perhaps more urgently than some. The first question, can a Christian be a soldier, is deceptively simple. The soldier's work is frequently mentioned both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, with no hint that it is in itself either dishonorable or unlawful. Soldiers as a group are not, for instance, denounced, as are the money changers of the temple. When soldiers came to John the Baptist for advice, he said, "Do no violence to no man, do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages. He did not suggest they should leave the army. In fact, he implied that they should continue to draw their wages as soldiers, but without complaint. It is remarkable that the four centurions mentioned in the New Testament are all commended in one way or another. The centurion at Capernaum is praised for his faith, and the centurion Cornelius was honored to the extent that in his home the first Gentile community was founded. There's no suggestion that these two men of faith were to give up their army careers. Of course, the scriptures can provide precedents without providing detailed answers to specific modern questions. They do not speak specifically of nuclear weapons, which, since 1945, have changed the nature of warfare to make war in any nation the possible means of ending human life on the globe, even threatening the existence of our planet. The nuclear threat may begin as a political or technological question, but it transcends religious, cultural, and national boundaries. No answer can be satisfactory which fails to consider its moral and religious dimensions. Keeping the peace in our age is a moral and political imperative, but peace is not just an absence of war, nor can it be achieved solely by maintaining a balance of power between enemies. For religious people, peace implies a relationship with God which entails forgiveness and reconciliation. Peace must be constructed on a basis of basic human values like truth, justice, freedom, and love. One may claim that war has settled some things, many of great importance. It was by war that Lot was saved from the Babylonians. War gave the land of Canaan to the Israelites, and war took it away from them. War established the Roman Empire, giving a century or more of peace as complete as the West has ever seen. War prevented the Saracens from completely dominating Europe. War achieved the American independence and put an end to slavery. On the other hand, many deeply sincere individuals, keenly aware of the evils of the world, believe strongly that they are best defending peace by refusing to bear arms. Others advocate active nonviolence to render ineffective any oppression attempted by force of arms. From the earliest days of the Christian church, some members have committed themselves to nonviolent lifestyles on the basis of their understanding that the gospel of Jesus prohibits all killing. The Christian vision is not passive about injustice and the rights of others. It rather affirms and exemplifies what it means to resist injustices by nonviolent means. All these options are open to individuals, but a government threatened by armed aggression, whether just or unjust, must defend its people. It may not choose nonviolence as long as even a minority of its citizens require defense. Today, the scale of horror of modern warfare makes it totally unacceptable as a means of settling differences between nations. It becomes increasingly difficult to use any kind of armed force, however limited initially in attention and destructive power, without facing the possibility of escalation to broader or even total war. We must, as a political reality, as well as a moral imperative, search for methods by which both individuals and nations may defend themselves without using violence. We must refuse to legitimize the idea of nuclear war. But this cannot happen all at once. A prominent member of the peace movement in Germany, Karl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, compared the situation with that of a mountaineer who suddenly wishes to be in the valley. His wish does not change his situation. What he has to do is climb down very carefully, a process requiring a great deal of time and patience. Building peace within and among nations is the work of many individuals and institutions. We as Christians, and especially as Latter-day Saints, can give an example in our own lives by establishing that kind of peace which Berthold of Regensburg, a most famous preacher in the Middle Ages, declared, is peace for God, peace with God, peace with ourselves, and peace with our neighbors. For God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of sound mind. Thanks.
I just changed my mind about what to read, Mary Jan. This won't make you too anxious. I was going to read from an essay, Fasting and Food, A Merciful Response to Conflict, which is an essay about an issue, as you can tell. And I just learned it will probably be published in a collection of essays by Bookcraft next year if I can get past the rest of their censors. But like all essays with messages, I can give it to you quick. The message is, as I discovered when I had the experience of touching the Pope's hand when he was shot and developing a good deal of emotional feeling about him and about solidarity, and therefore started Food for Poland back in 1981, we can solve many of the problems of world peace in a way that seems indirect, and that is by fasting once a week and contributing the food to feed the hungry. I really believe that if we would do that, and the church has led the way in their national fast and by establishing a program by which, if you don't know, you should know that you can contribute to their humanitarian fund, either through your ward clerk or directly through the PBO, and it will be used for very worthwhile purposes around the world. I think if we could get people to do that in an increasing way, that would be a wonderful solution to peace. But rather than do that, I was interested in Mary Jan's suggestion, we ought to try to describe what peace might be like. And so I've just written an essay recently where I think that's one of the things I'm trying to do. I'm still trying to figure out what this essay is about, so maybe you can tell me. But I think one of the things it's about is what it might like to be at peace. The title of the essay is Monte Cristo, and that's a very fortuitous title. It happens to be the name of a range of mountains up above Ogden, and it's about going fishing there. On the upper reaches of the South Fork of the Ogden River. The first part of the essay describes driving up there past Huntsville, past President McKay's home there, reflecting about him and about the Trappist Monastery, and then getting out finally on the river after a long hike and being taught by my friend Frank how to fly fish. This was back in the 70s, shortly after we had been together at St. Olaf College. So then let me read you a little bit about being on the river in peace. I tried casting in the riffles for a bit, but without doing any good, while Frank caught two more fish. Then he said, "Try the lower end of a hole, like the one under that falls, but down at the end of the pool where the water starts to speed up again. Cast up onto the edge of the current and let it float out into the quiet water." I tried what he said, but lost sight of the fly, so when the swirl came to the right of where I was looking, I jerked too late, and the fish had already felt the hook and let go. I started to move upstream, but Frank said, "Try it again. There are more fish there, and these cutthroats aren't too smart. He may take it again." This time I moved up a bit and kept my eye on the fly as it floated at the edge of the current, trying to learn how to be able to see it after it started floating down. Suddenly I saw a shadow come up under it, and it disappeared. I was surprised, but jerked in time and had my first fish. I caught four or five in this way at the bottoms of pools and holes, gradually learning how to see the fly as soon as it dropped, follow it on the current, and set the hook instantaneously when it disappeared. The trigger edge of my nerves got set so tight that sometimes I would strike too quickly, released by the shadowed movement of the fish to the fly, and pull it right out of its mouth. Once when I did this, I automatically finished the jerk back into a back cast, and then cast out again to the same spot where another fish took the fly. Then I triggered too quickly again, and so again continued into a back cast, and once more laid the fly out softly. Again, the fly disappeared, but I waited a beat and set the hook perfectly. The fish came straight up out of the water, the largest I had seen that day, maybe 11 inches and thick-bodied with the red stripe, these are cutthroat, clearly visible. I was so elated that I forgot to strip the line back and keep my rod tip high as the fish made a rush across the stream toward me. The unbarbed hook could only stay in place with pressure, and as the fish moved past me downstream, shaking the slack line, the hook came loose. As I finally pulled the line tight, the fly flipped straight back and hooked into my sleeve. I sat right down on the bank, letting the adrenaline slowly ebb away. Frank had been watching, but merely said, "That was a good fish. Come and try this next hole." He led me through a high mass of willows on the left bank, where we had to hold our rods high and keep ourselves up out of the impossible tangle by pushing over the bigger willow stems with our feet and then stepping on them from one to the next. On the right, the south wall of the canyon closed into the river, so that when we came out into a small meadow of grass and pipe stem sedge, we were looking across at a deep hole carved into the rock, which continued up maybe 400 feet. Pines were growing down to the water ahead on the left, so that the river seemed to come out of a dark cavern, with a sharp line where the sun, now approaching noon, broke straight down over the rock and across the river. Frank motioned that the hole was mine, but I whispered, "Go ahead," and moved back to his left to watch, feeling a strange reluctance to cast up into the cavern and yet overwhelming desire to see what might happen. Frank false cast a few times, the tiny gray atoms curving in a 50-foot figure eight in the sunlight and disappearing further into the darkness at the front of each cast. Then he let it drop and began slowly gathering line in his left hand. Just before the fly came out of the shadow into the bright water at the end of the hole, I could see the shadow moving up slowly from nearly 4 feet below it. With a quick rush, then a quick rush the last foot, and Frank struck just as the fish lifted the fly from the water. I knew I would have struck too soon. While he landed and released the fish, my breathing calmed down, but I said, "Let's have a sandwich." Since we didn't keep any fish, the large pocket at the back of our fishing vests made perfect lunch baskets, and we each took out cheese sandwiches and apples Charlotte had fixed. A small brook came out of the pine grove to our left, and where it crossed the tiny meadow, had filled with watercress, so I picked some and put them in the sandwiches, knowing the tang would go well with mild cheddar. In his vest, Frank had a collapsible tin cup, concentric rings of overlapping metal that beaded up with the cold water and that leaked a bit. But I laid right down on my belly to drink, putting my face deep into the pool where the brook opened into the river. We had decided to quit at 3, leaving us time to hike out and still have plenty of sunlight in case we got stuck going up through the mud. Frank had agreed it would be all right to eat 2 of the fish, so I brought some tinfoil and some butter that I'd left to cool in the little overflow stream at the bottom of the swale we had hiked down to the canyon. At 2 o'clock, we agreed to hike downriver about half a mile to where Frank remembered there was a beaver pond, and then fish back up the river. As we came out of the pines above the pond, a deer was going up a steep trail across from us that led into the cliffs. She turned to face us and calmly watched us as we watched back, frozen, hardly breathing. I could see her dark nose and eyes and the huge gray ears at the side, the sun shining through the hair along the edges. Then she slowly turned and walked behind a boulder. We stood there a while watching the fish, which must have been startled by the deer, slowly come back from the river above and from the banks into the clear, calm beaver pond. We knew they were too spooked to take a fly on such water, even if we could make a perfect presentation. So we started in the riffles just above and continued back up the river. We took turns with the holes and stretches of riffles, silently leapfrogging, not watching each other fish. The only sound over the complex sound of the river was the drone of a jet passing high above toward the Salt Lake Airport. We got back right at 3, just before the place where the swale we had walked down reached the river and its east ridge pushed the river out into a bend to the south. The fallen log had produced a long, narrow hole down the center of the river with ripples to the left. "Show me what you can do," Frank said, and I ignored the hole, working up the riffles on the left, and landed 2 9-inchers in quick succession. As I unhooked each, I quickly turned it over in my hand, grasped it upside down with the head protruding out 2 inches between my middle and forefingers, and wrapped its nose sharply on a rock. This killed the fish immediately. Frank continued fishing around the bend while I found a sandy edge and gutted the 2 fish. With a small blade of my pocket knife, I sliced them from anus to gills and laid the knife in the sand to clean later. I hooked my left forefinger through the mouth and my thumb up in front of the gills to close with it. This gave me the leverage to break out the front cartilage where both sets of gills were attached with my right forefinger and thumb, and then continue pulling downward to strip out the 2 front fins just behind the gills, and then all the inner organs right to the anus and break off the end of the intestine there. Then I held each fish in my left hand and pushed my right thumb up the backbone, breaking the membrane there that covers the main blood vessel and stripping out the blood to the front, continually washing the fish in the stream to take away the clotting blood. I retrieved the little bottle of butter, kept cold and hard in the water, went up to the ridge overlooking the river where we had first come down and built a small fire of dead pine branches in a small stone fire circle I had seen there on the way down. While the fire was burning into embers, I poured out flour and salt and pepper onto some tinfoil and rolled each fish in it, then watched Frank fishing below me, admiring the intense efficiency of his movements as he looked upriver, moved into position, cast and struck, played and released. As I calmed down, I suddenly realized I had needed to urinate for some time, but had unconsciously put it off, driven by the excitement of fishing and the job of preparing the fire and the fish. Now I felt the need intensely, from my belly down through my thighs. I moved over to some low elderberry bushes hid me from Frank, opened my fly, and let loose with great pleasure. Just as I did so, a hummingbird whirred up the river and hovered directly in front of me. Facing me so close, I could see glints in his carmine throat and on the heart-shaped inside of the tail that bobbed up and down to give him stability, black-tipped feathers with an inner ring of white. I stared back at him from a foot away, startled out of time, as his head remained perfectly still, the eyes fixed on me in the midst of the whirring wings and bobbing tail. Then I realized he had mistaken my father's huge streamer that I wore on my vest for a strange new flower. After a moment, he whirred off, showering glints of green from his back. When the fire had burned down to red and white embers and no smoke, I called Frank up, spread the butter along inside each fish, wrapped it in the foil, and placed it between the embers and a broken rock edge of the fire circle. I gave each fish about 2 minutes in this little oven and took it out of the foil, steaming. We ate with our fingers, licking the little puddles of butter and juice right off the foil. The seasoned skin we lifted off first had the strongest taste, the bread white flesh underneath, mild as Dover sole without its sauce. We ate in silence, casting the long-ribbed skeletons that we lifted out entire into the bushes behind us and licking the foil until it was clean enough to keep. I felt the danger of not getting out soon, more than Frank did, and was anxious to leave. But he lay down on the needles under a pine and talked about fishing. He told about going to Montana while he was in college and being in camp with a group of world-class fly fishermen, the kind who wrote books and gave expensive lessons and guided excursions. He was just beginning to learn, so one day secretly followed one of the most prestigious as he went out along Henry's Fork. All day we stayed under cover and watched him make perfect approaches and presentations, constantly changing his fly patterns and sizes. Frank was more and more astonished at the man's skill, the length and variety of his casts, the softness of the fly descending even before the line touched the water, the way he could cast across the current to an eddy and still keep a fly in a natural-looking float for 5 or 6 seconds, flipping his leader deftly back upstream before it could start to drag the fly. But the great angler didn't get a single strike. The fish simply were not taking anything on that day on that stretch of river. That night in camp, Frank overheard the others in the party who had gone out on the lake that day ask how the man had done, and he replied, "Oh, I only got 12. By the end of the story, Frank's voice had quickened and softened, turned in on itself so I could hardly understand. Why couldn't such a good fisherman simply tell the truth? Then he told me about a friend he had made that year in Rochester, about 60 miles from Faribault, where our church's district headquarters was and where Frank went for monthly meetings. The man was a counselor in the district presidency and assigned to supervise the Faribault branch, which meant he interviewed Frank each month and visited the branch often. Quote, "He was a gentleman, soft-spoken. He liked bringing his wife and coming on fast Sunday. We're still keeping up that custom you started of having a potluck lunch to break our fast after sacrament meeting. He learned about our problems with the congregation spread out 40 miles in every direction and only one or two experienced families, most of the rest new converts. As I came to know him better, he invited Joni and me to stay at their home when we went down for district conference. We met his daughter, a senior in high school and a cheerleader, and he mentioned once that a football player from a broken family had dated her a few times, had gone to church and on a few family outings with them, clearly attracted not only to her but to her secure home. Then one Sunday at a meeting he should have been conducting, it was announced she had just died that morning. We learned that she had tried to stop dating the boy and still be a friend, had even kept including him in family doings, but he had persisted, continued to pressure her, then joined the army and went away for a while. That Saturday he had returned on leave and tried to get her to date him, even parking outside early in the evening until they had the sheriff ask him to leave. Later he called and asked to come by to pick up something he had given her before, and when she let him in, he stabbed her and wounded a friend who had gone to the door with her, then fled. Lynn took her to the hospital and blessed her, but she died that morning. The next morning, Monday, Lynn and Kathy went to the high school and talked to the students in an assembly about what had happened. They told openly about their anger and grief. They also reminded the students that two families were grieving that day, their own and the young man's, and they should remember both. Nearly 2,000 students and town members came to the funeral and the burial. Lynn and Kathy stayed for hours at the cemetery, embracing the students, comforting and being comforted. Lynn told me later, "I don't want grief and anger to destroy us. I want to forgive." And they got help from their own prayers and those of church members, and from a psychologist who came and worked with the whole family. About a year later, I asked Kathy how she was doing. She said, "I am a happy woman who cries a lot." I told Frank about teaching religion at the LDS Institute at Weber State. I told him how I'd been asked by one of the students, Bishop, to speak in a sacrament meeting at her Ogden ward. I had talked about how hard it is to accept the modern revelations against materialism, how hard to live the covenants we make in the temple to consecrate everything we have to building the kingdom of God. I read from the sections of the Doctrine and Covenants that announce that the world lies in sin because one person possesses more than another, and that warn that we must be equal in physical things or we cannot be equal in spiritual blessings. The next week, the director of the Institute had come out into the office where I was checking my box for announcements and said, "I need to talk to you about a complaint about your talk last Sunday." I thought he was joking and joked back and started to leave, but he told me to come into his office. I learned that a member of the ward where I had talked had called church headquarters and tried to get me fired. The complaint had been referred back to the director. I told Frank how angry and humiliated I had felt, and still did, because that fellow saint had not talked to me but had gone over my head to headquarters, clearly interested mainly in punishment, and also because headquarters had taken the complaint seriously rather than referring him right back to me. I told him how I had described my talk to the director and how he had agreed it seemed to be orthodox enough, but he said, "It's best not to talk about controversial things like wealth." The director told me the man's name, and I went to see him, defensive and full of desire to condemn him. I found him a very amiable man, a collector of toy soldiers, which he displayed in gorgeous arrays all over his house. He said his anger had been aroused at me because the ward in a declining part of Ogden was full of widows and elderly couples on fixed incomes, and I had seemed to him to be accusing them of not doing enough for the church, asking them to sacrifice more. When we packed up, I bit the fly from my leader, reeled up the line and put the reel in my back vest pocket and carried the rod carefully in sections. It took almost an hour hard hiking, and we stopped often to drink from the stream until we reached the little reservoir. We finished in one long push to the car and then sat on the tailgate drinking Frank's grape juice right out of the spigot of the gallon-sized Coleman thermos, looking up at the slopes of Monte Cristo now turning golden in the westering sun. It wasn't until we put our gear in the back that I noticed I'd left my knife in the river.
Like Mike, I consider this text to be a work in progress. It's part of a larger work dealing with the silence of untold stories and violence in private lives. And while I feel that talking about war and peace and those issues on a public global scale is important, I also think it's important to talk about how peace has to be enacted in individual private lives of people. It's called A Story to Pass On. Everybody knew what she was called, but nobody anywhere knew her name. Disremembered and unaccounted for, she cannot be lost because no one is looking for her. And even if they were, how can they call her if they don't know her name? Although she has claim, she is not claimed. In the place where long grass opens, the girl who waited to be loved and cry shame erupts into her separate parts to make it easy for the chewing laughter to swallow her all away. It was not a story to pass on. It was not a story to pass on. Toni Morrison, Beloved. I was born into a world that seemed to be already dying before I arrived here. I do not know the words to rhyme, to sing, to make a song of peace, to ask the world to live again. But if I knew the words, I'd sing them not for the soldiers, but for the children born in a world that could destroy itself 100 times over and over and over. I would sing songs and tell stories again and again, so that the silent children might find a voice, so that the unnamed people in unmarked graves might find their names. But I do not know the words to sing a song of peace, so I will tell this song instead for those who pray for peace to end the violent lives. In London once I saw a peace march against nuclear weapons. The farmers and miners and punk rockers swarmed together to advertise their private fears on banners held above their heads. They appeared as one mass of moving bodies, but they did not march together. Some marched for peace, some marched for their unions, some marched for self, some marched to march. I started where they ended and walked backwards all through all 100,000 of them, marching the other direction toward the place they started from. And when I reached the end, nothing had changed. The weapons increased, the unions reached no resolution, the marchers still wanted things they couldn't name. As a beekeeper's child, I grew up with the feel of danger crawling on my neck and up my pant legs. I worked my August stealing honey from a swarm of stinging insects. The sweat and syrup and fear of stings clung to my skin, and every itch or stray hair became an attacking bee. The sickening sweet smell of wax, the sound of wings dive-bombing my head, and my fear of things crawling justified my need to kill them. And so I would wait until one trapped herself in her own honey, and then I would grab the nearest knife and slice her open, watching her yellow insides burst, feeling relief that I had destroyed her before she had a chance to attack me. But as I grew and saw death, I made a vow against it, a prayer that I would let things fly and creep within my house. And so I lifted the beetles and spiders off my walls and transported them outdoors. But then the moths came. I first spied a few larvae hanging from my ceiling, and then I noticed the adults flying through the house and the worms crawling through my grains. My ceiling and walls and cupboards finally wiggled with the squirming of their white bodies. I began to swat them and smash them and drown them. But the more I killed, the more they grew. I had no more reverence for the gray patterns on their backs, no more interest in the way they fluttered into night light.
I was 18 when I hated Arabs. Before then, I never knew one. And then I lived in London, where I walked past their shoe stores and food markets, where they would follow me home, whispering invitingly horrifying offers. I began to watch for the shape of their shadows behind me and the scent of their cigarettes, so I could run from them. And then one morning, three Palestinians arrived on the doorstep of the BYU Center to speak stories of their disinheritance. For some reason, they weren't supposed to be there, so we vowed to keep their visit a secret. After the lecture and the lunch, I played my favorite song on the piano, and the woman in the group sat beside me and moved her head in rhythm with my fingers. "You play beautifully," she said. "No," I told her. "It is only the song. It's a beautiful song." And I played it again and again, and I felt the fear and poison drip out of my fingers. I never saw the Palestinian woman again, but I thought about her when I saw 19-year-old Israeli soldiers carrying machine guns up Masada, the place where people jump to death rather than facing captivity. And each time I play the song, I think about her skin and eyes and hair that mark her as an Arab and make her beautiful like music. I know a direct descendant of Muhammad who cannot return to his homeland because he has joined the church. His brothers have vowed to kill those who become Christian. And so he lives in hiding in a new place with a new identity. He cannot tell the world the story he has chosen to live. If he does, he will no longer live it. On the night I first met him, he told me stories of starving children and hardened soldiers and broken beaches that had been smooth and clean when he was a child. But he wants to return there, to the place that forbids him, to sift through the debris and recover that which is still his. "Je t'aime," he told me. "You do not," I said in shaking French. "You do not know me. I am not the self I speak in French. I speak English," he said. I could not tell him that he did not speak it enough to know how English has shaped me, show me parts of light while blinding me from others, that I could never love him because I could never tell him who I am. "Is it because I am Arab?" "No," I told him, wondering if I was lying or speaking the truth. "Mais je t'aime," he whispered. I said goodbye because I could not give words to say how I wanted to know him some, but not too much. He made me promise not to write about him, and I said yes. Yet I break my vow and tell his story. I am telling his story over and over again so that he will matter, so that people will know that a man cannot say who he is, or his brothers will kill him. But I do not name him. I also know an old woman who will experience both her birth and death in a small French town where the empty buildings look like only the dead and insane live there. At a young age, she married a man knowing that he would beat her, but hoping that new violence might be easier to bear than the terror of her father's house. Her husband demanded her body, then made her sleep on the floor, even in the winter. She gave birth to a deaf daughter, a woman whose husband drinks and beats her, a son who drinks and beats his wife. She can hardly walk, because after 40 years, the bruises stopped healing. I sat in her apartment near the coal stove, listening to the couple upstairs screaming and beating each other. She did not notice, did not move. The loud hating had become so much a part of her life that she forgot that it was horrible. The screaming got louder and louder, mixing with the sound of things breaking, until she lifted her head and laughed. Laughed because if she cried, she would hurt too much. She asked me to call her grandma, as though she wanted to mother someone who can escape her life, which hangs on her daughters like a chain. And if I named her as grandmother, then I must also break her silence, to speak the words too terrible for her to cry as she lay in her husband's bed, knowing that he would beat her to sleep on the floor, and that the life they are making, as she gritted her teeth beneath him, would also be silent. My sister, the one right after my birth, the one who was supposed to be mine, supposed to mimic my words, cannot speak, cannot walk, cannot reach out her arms, cannot tell me what she thinks. But she has eyes, eyes to watch the world she cannot join. If she had a voice, what would I teach her to speak? I was 7, curled fetally in the back of a station wagon that smelled like trips I'd never gone on. They had taken my sister with non-walking legs and unspeaking mouth into a house for other silent children. I hid my eyes and my arms so that I would not see the place where boys wore helmets to keep them from smashing their heads into walls. I could not explain to my father when he asked me to go inside the house of voiceless children that I hid without crying because my sister could not be mine. For nearly 2 decades, I avoided my silent sister, the helmeted boys, the girls who chewed themselves, and the diapered men who wander the hallways looking for hands to touch. But when I returned as an adult, the walls still smelled of medicine and urine, and the boys still smashed their heads into the walls. But I also heard the cries of the silent children, wailing to the world the songs they cannot sing, the words they cannot speak, their heads and arms waving wildly without stopping, becoming the dance their legs will not produce. I have seen these stories, and I try to tell them, to speak the unspeakable and name the unnameable in a fight against the silence that makes the stories repeat themselves among the living. I've been to the massive graveyard in Russia that honors the siege on Leningrad and watched the women place fresh tears and roses on the massive graves where thousands lie. I've seen French graveyards also dressed in ribbons and chrysanthemums, like a century of funerals happened just yesterday, and women in black who return to their homes to repeatedly reenact the tragedy of living. I've shared a train with an old German man who mumbled the world wars back to life as we walked forward to Amsterdam, healing the peace with the stories he passed on. And it was not the death I mourned, but the absence of life in the living. But I have also seen the silent children playing, rolling their wheelchairs and heads in offbeat rhythm, approaching me, holding their hands out, waiting for me to touch them. I have shared a song of hope with a woman who cannot claim her homeland. I have watched a young Arab willingly dive into the rebirth of baptism, knowing that he would surface to death threats. I have seen an old French woman creep to church on the legs her husband destroyed so that she might pause and pray and sing. After the enemy retreats and the troops return to safety and wounds, the captains collect their medals and the war is over. The war is not gone. Peace is not won, but reached for, prayed for, lived and spoken. It's lost and gained and lost again every day in the lives of old women, young Arabs, and silent children. And so I find myself marching for peace, not once in a quick London afternoon, but again and again as I war with myself in the silence of unnamed lives.
Mary Jan asked me to read my short story, A Song for One Still Voice, which first appeared in the Ensign in March 1979 and then in a slightly more complete form in Greening Wheat in 1982. It occurs to me that in this context, the experience of peace, which this story could be said to celebrate, may seem a little too withdrawn, private, and solitary, perhaps even too much a gift rather than a result, but that it's still to be cherished for all that. A Song for One Still Voice. He is awake and knows the time. In its reliable way that he does not yet trust, his mind has waked him just before the alarm should go off. His side of their bed in the small room must be jammed close to the wall, so he leans across his sleeping wife to reach the nightstand and press down the button. He has set it early to have time to dress, get his shovel, and walk to the head gate, so he has maybe 20 minutes. And stirred by the swell of her hip against his belly, he half wishes to wake her. With the children, there is little time when they are fully alone and quiet like this. But she was up till almost 11, settling the girls, and when he finally held her, she turned, snuggled her backside against him, tucked his arm under hers, his hand spread on her chest, and mumbled into her pillow, "Let me go to sleep like this." He did, lay listening to random snapping and easing of joists, cyclic rumble and hush of heater, long past the time when his fingers told him she slept, till he turned over to find his separate sleep. He knows she still needs this placidity that he senses with his whole body. Touched, her skin would lie still as water without a breath of air moving on it. But he slides out of the covers and scoots down his side, the light string brushing his scalp, so he thinks for an instant, spider. Bugs are one problem of this old house. Winter drives them in, and as spring swells into summer, they will propagate madly. He's taught the girls to stomp on the slightest suspicion of a black widow. Cold is another problem. Their northwest corner room is farthest from the heater, which is central only in having been built into the wall between kitchen and living room so it blows both ways. Keep the girls' northeast corner room warm. They must prop kitchen and bedroom doors at angles calculated to guide an optimal airflow. In winter, one of them will rise at least once each night to check and retuck blankets. Not quite 26, he's begun to understand why some old people, his grandmother, brag of lasting out the winter. One night this past January, he spent almost 8 hours with a propane torch trying to thaw the water line. He'd come in for 5 minutes or so in every hour, sit at the kitchen table to drink hot chocolate, both hands on the mug, shoes off so warmed air would blow across his feet. Under the house, gloved hand gripping the pipe to feel when the water would start, he knew his first terror of the simple elemental world.
And in this rented house, far more than in 3 years of apartments at school, he has felt on himself and on Lee the entire weight of their needs of shelter, heat, food, clothes. He stands at the foot of the bed, thankful for carpet even if it is cool. And it is spring now, the worst of the cold past, and if there is no late frost, the lilacs may all bloom. First time in years, if it happens, the old residents say. But the hawthorn came through anyway last year, and will again. A monumental bouquet of red and green, he's glad to have lived to see on a front lawn, even if not his own. A sort of stewardship. Just out that blinded window, he could see the hawthorn if it were day. It's a bloom already open. He remembers coming into the room one afternoon last August to a moment's stunned joy at the pale yellow light flooding through the drawn blind. He's been happier here this past year than anywhere or any time else. From the dresser mirror, his clownish ghost shimmers back at him as he stoops with knees spread to hold his pants up while he reaches his shirt. He wonders if anything has been left between here and the door to trip him going out. But the way is clear, his shoes to the added-on porch that he and a colleague wired and plumbed and vented for washer and dryer, and he and his wife papered with yellow stripes. Their first try, and not a bad job. The door to the kitchen closed, he opens the back porch door and sits on the steps to pull on the heavy steel-toed shoes he bought years ago to work in the sheetrock plant the summer before he met Lee. The stiff shoes pinch and bunch his toes. Standing again to take his hat and gloves from the hooks below the back porch window, he remembers coming home early one afternoon last week, quiet to surprise him, walking through the house and opening the door to the porch and seeing them blurred and pasteled through this water-spotted glass and screen. Sitting under the blossoming apple trees, petals strewn thick around them on the grass, the little girls calling to make it rain, and she shaking a low branch to shower more on them. He stood and watched, drowned in delight that he could find no words for, hardly daring to go on out because his coming might be less to them than what they already had. Later, he walked them to the corner and across the highway for soft ice cream. Picking up the shovel he stood last night by the step, he crosses the yard to the southeast corner, climbs the fence at the solid post there, pulls his shovel through and makes his way along the ditch that runs through his neighbor's deep backyard. A good man and kind to them, though Carl does not more than mildly like him yet and so feels undeserving of even shared surplus corn or broccoli or seeds. He stumbles and almost falls over a short tree stump that he knows well enough to avoid and chides himself again for not buying flashlight batteries. His shovel striking the ground has waked the dog, who comes dragging his chain from his house under a honey locust, sniffing and starting to growl, then wagging his tail when he catches Carl's approved scent. Carl squats to stroke the dog and scratch his ears, trying to recall his name. He hasn't had a dog since high school, and it pleases him to make friends. He wouldn't mind just staying here and patting and talking to this one. But it's time to start the turn, and he whispers, "Go back to sleep, boy, it's okay," and walks up through the driveway to the head gate in the cement ditch running north on the east side of the block. They don't have a dog because the fur makes Lee's asthma act up. It takes only a minute to aim the water at his yard. A big stream, so he doesn't need to seal the edges of the gate with mud. What runs on by won't matter. It is also simpler to walk back around the block, so he does that, his shovel balanced on his shoulder by his wrist crooked over its handle. He crosses the tracks he supposes they're on the wrong side of, though in Cedar the distinction hardly exists, and walks into the hard glare of mercury vapor lamps along the highway that runs straight west of the interchange. He dislikes the lamps for the livid cast they give to skin, the tarry-looking shadows they throw around even pebbles. So he's glad to get past the big, blocky furniture store warehouse, turn the corner, and walk in dark toward his house. Out of the glare, he can look up at the stars, thick, clear, shining a steady, warm light. Living at home, he'd use his telescope on any night like this, could find his way from constellation to constellation, predict where, aimed carefully, the 6-inch mirror would dazzle him with a nebula, a far galaxy like M31 and Andromeda, the jeweled globe of stars in Hercules, toward which the whole solar system slowly spins. It felt good to know the sky, and he'd wonder what it was like to know it as God does, galaxies and even clusters of galaxies flung like seeds to the far fences of the universe. He'd read that a planet within the great Hercules cluster would be seared in the light of a thousand suns, and supposed that to be like the place where God dwells. The sidewalk runs straight to the edge of his yard, stops for a foot-wide strip of bare red clay, then resumes as his own front walk, angling up to the narrow concrete steps. In the backyard, before the water, he has time to check his dams for watering the trees and flooding the small lawn. He really doesn't need all the water this second turn of the season. Their garden is only half planted, peas, carrots, lettuce, thin grass-like spears of onion sets. He remembers last fall when he came out from hanging several onion-stuffed nylons in the storage room and saw their cat leap 3 feet into the air to claw down the hummingbird that had darted at the hollyhocks all summer. He himself pounced on the cat to rescue the bird, got it in his hand, felt the shock of its unimaginably intense life, saw at its throat what he first thought was blood, then realized was the ruby, glowing in the dusk as if the bird bore the summer's whole harvest of light. Then his hand stunned open, the bird flew away. Kneeling in the grass to wedge a chunk of brick more firmly in the bank, he smells fresh mint growing along the ditch and bends closer to breathe it. He has seen Lee put a leaf to each nostril and inhale, an ecstasy of breath. They should learn to make mint tea. Now the water arrives, a finger-sized trickle swelling to fill the ditch and start spilling on the lawn. He stands, steps back near the house, and follows its spread by silver flickerings in the grass. The garden furrows were set right last time. He won't need to check them for an hour. He did not think he'd like gardening. His parents had a large garden and made him help weed it, a chore he escaped when he could. He still doesn't like weeding, but to have something grow by his own labor, something they can eat, even if not at much less cost than buying, feels good. When the lawn is a still, blade-pricked sheet of dusky silver, he turns to go in. He'll sleep on the couch near the bedroom door, and he steps into the bedroom to get a light blanket in case of cold. Coming back out, he kneels by the bed to kiss Lee on her warm, pulsing temple, again half wishing to wake her. The faint odor of the vinegar she rinsed her hair with last night reminds him how she came from the shower, blossoming from sharp spray, how she tangles sense and memory. There is no loneliness like the body, nor any delight. "Sleep," he whispers, content that she'll not know this riffle in the hidden stream of her ear. He will sleep without resetting the alarm and see if his mind will wake him again in an hour. But when he does wake again, it is because one of his daughters has cried in her sleep. Guessing why, he takes a dry diaper with him, untwists her from her covers, changes her, for once without rousing her to open her eyes, and turns her warm, tumblesome body end for end so she lies as she should. When he stands and turns to check the older girl, he sees through the windows, taking both in at once, unbelievably, snow. The sight stuns him with delight and fear harmonized like a major fifth. And then he knows, barely trusting this, that it is some surprise of the light. Stepping to the east window and bending to look out and up, he sees it is so. Pale light pouring from a risen last quarter moon and resting on bare clay, on weeds, on barely flowing water, on apple branches like silvery, weightless snow. Looking at it, he is weightless, in free fall as if the earth has dropped from under him, or as if he is drawn up with the world's tidal bulge and loosed in the gravity of light, yearning farther out and from deeper within than in any prayer he has ever spoken. Undeserved, abounding, grace rings in his bones.
I think this is the final reading, isn't it? Here, Jen. I'm going to read a poem by Emma Luthane. It's just a very short one, and it's called Considering the End. So finally I consider only life. The Holocaust ahead would leave no one behind to question how we happened not to happen in any moment but our tragic own. I have only one voice, one language, one set of memories to look back on. 1,000 impulses to look ahead, if I will, if there is time to consider. How much for the earth? What would I keep?
blue mountains against a black sky. Smiles exchanged so well we do not know our ages or conditions. Snow melted, leaves moving again. In a voice, rain finding its way to the stream. Heat rising like wands from the desert. A cold drink, the touch of hair enough, all by itself. First apricot, pickle sharp, a phone ringing on time. Lights going on, wanting them off for the dark. A song flooded with memory, smell of pinion in fire, onion in stew. A dancer watched like a child, and a child in flight like a dancer. Hot soup, hot bath, hot air to take to the canyon. Aging slowly from the bones outward, time to pick and choose. A wooden spoon, the white whisper of a needle in cloth, laughing like tossed water, like skis on snow. Smell of soap, hot animal, an apple, crisp. A ball hit, a lover, dream of a dead mother stroking our cheek. An idea, the paeta, the hand of God, a word, a prayer. The word, the earth far from without form and void. The earth created and not destroyed. If altered, not back to darkness upon the face of the deep. You, me, combinations of color and sound, the spirit of God moving upon the waters. A child born. An ant with reason to blow, draw, blow. A celebration for the end of war. A new generation, inevitable. The coming of sun, because it is good. A world alive for a blue door to open onto. A candle, a kiss, eyes meeting, holding, life to consider. Then, no more considering, hypothesizing, or tolerating. No litmus paper ending in a cosmic petri dish. No more silence. For the earth, for the life in me, in you, I say yes. Yes, thank you, yes. In your breath, fuse with mine, even ashes stir and glow. It's time we said together yes to life, to ashes, simply no.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? We have 9 minutes. If there are any questions that you have for any of the readers? If not, no questions? If not, we'll just close early then. I'd like to thank especially... There was a question. I'm sorry.
I don't know if Gene ever go back and get your knife.
He wants to know if Gene ever went back and got his knife.
There's a story about Shangri-La and never been back. I'm just wondering how far you're pushing.
I always tell the truth in my eyes.
So we've heard.
Are there any other questions? Okay, if not, I would like to thank the readers and those of you who listened to us and that we had a reason to read. Let me remind you that this session and all of the other sessions are on tape, and you can get a tape in the lobby. And the session is closed then. Thank you.